on our upcoming special edition of On the Media, we're doing a deep dive on everything U.S. Supreme Court. We've been interviewing like crazy for weeks and put together a pretty compelling package, if I do say so myself. The problem is, one of the segments in which we found fault with the court on transparency grounds was so damn compelling, the court fixed the problem we were reporting on before we even had a chance to mete out the shame. In the interest of our own transparency, we didn't want to keep the package in the special and look silly for arguing a moot case, and we also didn't want to waste our efforts because the story and its resolution are both still kind of remarkable. And so, this podcast extra. The story of the story started last week when we recorded an interview with Adam Liptak, who covers the Supreme Court for the New York Times. Liptak described the justices' little-known practice of editing their opinions after those opinions have been issued, long after and many times over. Now, all fresh opinions are labeled as drafts, but nobody knew how rough the drafts were until last year when Harvard Law professor Richard Lazarus wrote a long essay documenting the practice. Here's Adam Liptak describing how even the standard disclaimer hadn't prepared him for the degree of revisionist jurisprudence.
It's a little misleading. It says that the opinion is subject to formal revision before publication, and that the court may correct typographical or other formal errors. I'm not sure what formal error means exactly, but I don't think it means in most people's minds that the court would actually change something of legal substance, and yet occasionally they do.
When Lazarus at Harvard published his paper, were you blindsided? Or did you go, oh, yeah, you know what? That makes sense. I hadn't really noticed before, but yeah, that scans.
We had, right around the time that Professor Lazarus's paper was becoming available, lived through an interesting instance of Justice Scalia having to correct a very embarrassing mistake on his part, where he accused the EPA of something, got it exactly backwards, and should have known better because he'd written the original decision, which was the backwards piece of it. So within hours, that decision was corrected. So we knew that that kind of immediate correction was possible. Didn't know that there are corrections being made even 5 years later.
Give me a for instance.
In a major gay rights case, Justice O'Connor, in a concurrence, says, well, at least we can agree, Justice Scalia in dissent and I, that equal protection principles would compel a certain result. And lo and behold, years later, it's disappeared from the official version. Even though that passage continues to appear on the internet in various sources. In fact, lower court judges actually debated the statement, and law professors have used it in teaching the case, and it remains in place in many databases.
Although it doesn't really exist, because it's been expunged from the record.
That's almost a philosophical question, isn't it? Does it exist? And that kind of scrub of not the central holding of a case. I don't want to suggest that this is some kind of weird black helicopter conspiracy where they're actually changing the law in really important binding ways. But they're tinkering. They're withdrawing asides that suggested they have a view about a particular issue of law and then thinking better of it.
So it's not revisionist justice necessarily, but a kind of revisionist history.
And maybe, you know, maybe it's to the good. The real question is not whether they should do it. You probably want the best work product imaginable, I suppose. You certainly don't want typographical errors. You don't want factual errors. And you don't want even suggestions about what the law is when it's not that. But what you don't have from the court is any meaningful transparency. So these changes are being made quietly, without public announcement, and leaving in place with the internet lots of sources that don't make the revisions. So people turn to a source, you know, good sources, doing their best, that don't know that actually they're not publishing the most current version of the opinion.
You mentioned the Scalia revision in an EPA case. There's another EPA-related decision from former Justice Lewis Powell that actually undid language in the decision that would have permitted citizens to sue the EPA about enforcing the Clean Water Act. It seemed like a really substantive change, not merely a grammatical or typographical edit.
Completely agree. It wasn't central to the case. It was an aside, but it was a flat declaration about what the law is, and then it disappeared.
And lest we believe that this is some new phenomenon, Lazarus found examples going back to one of the court's most infamous decisions, the Dred Scott case, back in 1857.
And back then, the revisions were even more freewheeling. Chief Justice Roger Taney added about 18 pages to his majority opinion after it was announced.
Not just typos, you're saying?
No. That may be the high water mark of after-the-fact revision.
Now, after the chat with LibTac, we planned to air this conversation we had with a guy named Dave Zvenich. He's a lawyer who has created a Twitter bot called SCOTUS Servo that can identify edits in Supreme Court opinions.
So what SCOTUS Servo does is it goes to the Supreme Court's website. It looks to see for each opinion on the Supreme Court's website whether there's been a change in sort of the signature, the fingerprint, if you will, for the opinion. If there is a change, it downloads it, checks to see against the list of other files on my computer to see whether or not there's been a change. And if there is a change, it tweets out to the public that this change has been made. But then it does another thing, which is kind of cool. We can see, essentially, the changes that are made in the opinion by looking at one version of the opinion and the second version of the opinion and doing what's called a diff, which is the difference between the first version and the second version, and providing a little red box around the change that was made in the first instance to the second.
All right, you see how great this story was going to be in the show? We heard about a secret thing the court was doing, and we even found the guy with the solution, and that's where the whole story would have ended. But on Monday, our lead producer on the Supreme Court show, Alana Casanova-Burgess, was forwarded an email by Adam Liptak from The Times. The email was from Kathleen Arberg, who was the public information officer at the Supreme Court. And it went a little something like this. Alana, could you please read this?
Quote, beginning with the October term 2015, post-release edits to slip opinions on the court's website will be highlighted and the date they occur will be noted. The date of any revision will be listed in a new, quote, revised column on the charts of opinions, in chambers opinions, and opinions related to orders under the, quote, opinions tab on the website. The location of a revision will be highlighted in the opinion. When a cursor is placed over a highlighted section, a dialog box will open to show both old and new text.
We did try to reach Kathleen Arberg with a whole mess of questions about this and about how it's going to work. But the term is just beginning, which is why we're focusing on the court. And I guess she's kind of busy. Anyway, she never got back to us, leaving it to Alana to explain everything. In the press release, there were references to something called slip opinions. What's a slip opinion?
So a slip opinion is one of the stages of a U.S. Supreme Court opinion. When they first issue their decision from the bench, that's known as the bench opinion, a slip opinion is printed out. So that's one of the ways that drafts work for the Supreme Court. And we've learned in this process that it can take several years before the opinions are published in hardcover books, and sometimes it can take even 5 years. And what's not clear, which Richard Lazarus raised this week, is whether changes that can happen later in the process will be made public. So we'll see about that, but it is a move towards transparency from the court, so exciting start to the term.
Getting back to the press release, Alana, there was also a reference to link rot, which is a problem we all run into periodically, where you click on a URL and it turns out not to be there anymore. What's the court doing about that?
So a couple of years ago, three professors at Harvard, and yeah, Harvard is doing a lot of work on the court, they published a study on link rot and legal citations, and they found that 50% of the links on the Supreme Court's opinions were broken. And another study from Yale put that number closer to like 30%. But again, this is a big problem for legal researchers who need to be able to find precedent and see how opinions are related to other opinions. And now the court itself is going to post materials it's linking to on a page at supremecourt.gov, and they'll do that going back to 2005. So they're trying to solve that problem too.
Now, on the show, the actual Supreme Court special, we're going to be discussing the so-called greenhouse effect, which is named after the legendary Supreme Court reporter Linda Greenhouse, whose journalism was reputed to actually influence the court. Is this evidence of the Liptak effect?
Who knows? We could call it the Lazarus effect after the Harvard professor who wrote the very thorough study of the non-finality of these justice opinions. But we did just hear from Liptak that this was a big problem for lawyers and for academics when so many different versions of opinions are floating around on databases online. You know, how can these professionals quote from the record? You see a similar problem with the link rot. Plus, there had been some other movement last year on this issue, and I guess this is where we can play that tape of Adam Liptak, Justice Ginsburg this past term, blah, 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 right?
Justice Ginsburg this past term twice had the court's public information office send emails to the press corps announcing that she'd made changes to fix factual mistakes. And Justice Sotomayor did the same thing once. But it's a very slow-moving court, very conservative in a small C sense. They announced last year that they would, before the end of 2016, put the briefs filed at the court online, which, you know, is the sort of thing you might think a high school student could achieve in an afternoon. So it's not the most nimble institution.
So at least two justices on the bench felt this was enough of a problem to change the policy, at least for themselves. So that might have influenced the decision more than Adam.
So in the landmark case, the United States Supreme Court v. On the Media, we've lost. We got scooped by the very institution we're reporting on. But on the Supreme Court special, which is coming this week, we have plenty of other stuff. We may as well take this opportunity to promote the living bejesus out of it. So what's coming, Alana, in your show?
Is there a way for me to sound excited without sounding cheesy?
You can say, I'm actually glad you asked me that question.
I'm actually glad you asked me that question, Bob. We have one of our patented breaking news consumer handbooks, this time for understanding, analysis, and reporting on the court. We'll also hear about how ordinary people become poster children for cases in a way they may never have expected. That's your piece. And we've got a little musical number about cameras in the courtroom.
I have one last question for you, Alana. As always, or as almost always, the show is divided between Brooke and me, each of us doing interviews and pieces. Of the two hosts, who would you say is...
Oh, my God, Bob. Bob, Justice Scalia is on the phone. I've got to go. I got to get out of here. I got to go take the call.
Liar, liar, pants on fire.
Bye.
All right, Alana, thank you very much.
See ya.
She's fired. Alana Casanova-Burgess is the lead producer of OTM's Supreme Court special, the working title of which, by the way, in case you're interested, is Hot Bench. This is an On the Media podcast extra. I'm Bob Garfield.